This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, as China boasts that its efforts to slow the spread of the coronavirus are working, we'll hear from an infectious diseases expert as we wait to see if Australians stranded on board a disease-ridden cruise ship off Japan will finally be evacuated. And Boys Club, the toxic culture at one of Australia's most prestigious schools.
Just gutted. Yeah, gutted, and this is how we think about you. We don't care.
He ended up being hospitalised, needing psychiatric care. He was crushed by the institution. He was crushed.
Plans are being finalised to evacuate Australians stuck on board the Diamond Princess cruise ship at Yokohama in Japan, and it's expected the federal government will announce details later today. The US government's removed some of its citizens, and several other countries have announced plans to do the same. There are now hundreds of cases of COVID-19 on board the ship, and the ABC's learnt that 24 Australians are among them. Our North Asia correspondent, Jake Sturmer, is in Yokohama.
Right now, there aren't many ways off this boat. Every day, new cases are confirmed. The infected are taken off and to hospitals around Japan. As the infection rate continued to rise, the United States decided it would get its citizens out, chartering flights and evacuating them from the ship throughout last night. Paul and Cheryl Maleski were among them.
We're glad to be going home, though, and our family feels relieved.
They've been left with so many questions.
Biggest challenges have been the uncertainty. You know, first we're tested for the coronavirus or the COVID-19 virus, and then, you know, we don't really hear anything, and then we don't know. All along, we've not known how we were going to get home.
It's a question many Australians on board are wondering, too. Evacuation flights from Canada, Hong Kong and Taiwan are due to arrive, and pressure is mounting on the Australian government to do the same. A decision is expected to be made in the next few days, but authorities are waiting on advice from an Australian public health expert who for much of yesterday wasn't able to get on board the ship. Paul and Coralie Williamson are just waiting to find out what any evacuation plan might look like and whether that may mean more quarantine before they get too excited at the prospect of a charter flight home.
So while there's a vacuum of this information, the more the mind just spins, doesn't it, with all sorts of scenarios. So I know that the Princess Cruises keep saying we're trying to be open and transparent. We're trying to send out information as soon as we get it. And maybe it's been out of their hands to a certain extent. Complex, very complex.
Japan is now battling its own outbreaks off the ship. An 80-year-old woman who contracted the virus from her son-in-law died, and at least 38 cases have been confirmed in the country. 19 of those are in Tokyo alone. They include a doctor and a taxi driver. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is working to keep the situation under control.
The situation is changing minute by minute. Japan has had its first fatality from the infection, and several new cases infection routes have yet to be identified. I've asked experts to help the government form a clear picture of the outbreak.
That's a picture that changes day by day, and for the passengers on board the Diamond Princess, they're focusing on their freedom, whenever that may come. This is Jake Sturmer in Yokohama, reporting for AM.
China's government claims it's managed to slow the spread of the virus outside the epicenter Hebei, with the number of new infections declining. But Beijing's claims of openness and transparency are being undermined by the disappearance of two independent journalists in Wuhan. Here's China correspondent Bill Birtles.
In the Chinese capital, melting snow and warmer days, a sign the end of China's winter of anxiety and fear may be in sight. That's the message China's government is pushing, claiming that outside of the epicenter Hubei province, there are fewer and fewer new coronavirus infections. Despite this, Beijing is now ramping up the quarantine measures. A security guard taking temperatures at the entrance of a housing compound tells AM anyone who now comes to the capital from anywhere must self-isolate for 14 days. In parts of Hubei, local governments are increasingly anxious to outdo each other on quarantine measures, sealing off compounds, ordering people not to leave their homes, and using increasing force for those who defy the orders. Over the weekend, China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China's being open with the world about the virus.
In the spirit of openness and transparency, we promptly notified the world about the outbreak and shared the genetic sequence of the virus. We have been working closely with the World Health Organization. China has effectively curbed the spread of the outbreak beyond our borders.
But China's leader Xi Jinping has used state media to reveal he first ordered action on the outbreak on January the 7th, 2 weeks before health authorities publicly confirmed human-to-human transmission. Government media reports at the time omitted any mention that Mr. Xi was addressing the virus threat, prompting questions if it was already serious enough to warrant the Chinese president's attention. Why didn't he tell the public at the time? There are also fears for two independent journalist vloggers who travelled to Wuhan to document the outbreak. Both have disappeared. As the death toll in Hubei continues to rise, there are also questions about whether Xi Jinping will go ahead with a massive political meeting in just over 2 weeks. More than 3,000 delegates from across China are supposed to travel to Beijing and meet for 10 days. An independent commentator, Wu Qiang, says the new very restrictive measures in Beijing, forcing every returnee to quarantine themselves, is likely a sign Xi Jinping still wants the political congress to go ahead.
If they cancel, it would be a serious political setback. The economy and people's normal lives have already been stalled. This would show Xi Jinping has made mistakes and isn't able to control the situation.
Whether Xi Jinping cancels or goes ahead with the National People's Congress will be a real test of what's most important in China, containing the outbreak or politics. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing, reporting for AM.
Professor Kanta Subbarao is based at the Doherty Research Institute in Melbourne. She's the director of the WHO Collaborating Centre for Reference and Research on Influenza, and she was in Geneva last week for a meeting about COVID-19. Professor, what worries you most about this virus?
I think the most worrying thing is the fact that it spreads so easily from person to person.
China has locked down Hubei province and some of its super cities in an effort to stop it from spreading. I think 500 million people are now affected by policies that Beijing has put in place to try and restrict this spreading. Has that been aggressive enough to stop it from spreading?
Well, it certainly is an unprecedented, quite a draconian measure. And I think the hope is that it will limit the spread or at least slow the spread. It remains to be seen how effective this strategy will be, because the Hubei province, or at least Wuhan, was locked down around the 23rd of January. And so we have to see how much of an effect this has. It has something on this scale has never been done before. And so usually the modeling suggests that measures such as, you know, restricting travel and restricting entry and so on will delay spread by a few days. It may not be able to completely halt it.
You talked about your fear that it's spreading very quickly from person to person. Do we know how it's managed to jump from animals to humans? Do we understand that yet?
No, that's a very good question. We have hints from the previous two events where a coronavirus crossed from animals to humans. So the coronaviruses are a large family of viruses, and many species have their own coronavirus. So humans have had coronaviruses that cause common colds for years, and, you know, they normally, viruses don't cross species barriers. The first time this happened, where an animal coronavirus infected humans, was SARS. And then about 10 years later was the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or MERS coronavirus. And now this is a third. We do know from very, very careful studies done by scientists at the Wuhan Institute of Virology that bats carry viruses that are quite similar to SARS and now to this virus. So we know that there are viruses out there in nature. Now, what it takes for an animal virus to cross into humans is the ability of the virus to actually bind human cells and infect them. And we know that bat viruses are, some bat coronaviruses have the necessary ability to bind human cell receptors.
You led crucial research on those emerging viral diseases, SARS and MERS. Are there any lessons yet that you can see from this virus, COVID-19?
Well, there are similarities and there are differences. The big difference is the spread from person to person, which really only happened with very close contacts and usually in medical settings with SARS and MERS. We didn't see this sort of community spread that we're seeing with this virus. So that in that regard, it is quite different. On the other hand, we did learn quite a bit from studying SARS and MERS. And so we know a little bit about the structure of the virus, about the characteristics of the proteins that we will need to target antiviral treatment and vaccine development.
Yeah, a vaccine is still some time away. Some reports are saying that it could be 18 months away. If that's so, are these draconian measures, as you put it, the best way to stop it from spreading?
Well, public health measures did stop the spread of and actually controlled the SARS outbreak. And MERS has been relatively controlled with public health measures. But in both of those instances, there were independent incursions from animals into humans and then fairly limited spread, largely in healthcare settings. So they were controlled by public health measures, and that was the big hope with this virus as well, because we don't actually have available right now. We don't know what antiviral drugs and vaccines are not available yet. There are a lot of strategies to develop vaccines, and some of them are really much more accelerated compared to the usual platforms that we've used in the past. But however, you know, generating a vaccine is just the first step. It would have to be then tested for safety and effectiveness in humans. And that's why, even though a vaccine might be available within weeks to months, by the time it is available for use widely in humans, it would be more than a year away.
Professor Subbarow, thank you for talking to AM.
Thank you.
That's Professor Carter Subbarow, the Director of the WHO Collaborating Centre for Reference and Research on Influenza. It's orientation week for some universities this week, giving many students their first taste of campus life before the academic year begins next week. But not all students will be there. 100,000 of them are stranded in China because of the travel restrictions in place to contain the spread of the virus. 4,000 of them study at the Australian National University, and the university's Vice Chancellor is Professor Brian Schmidt, who, incidentally, has just had his term renewed for another 5 years. He joined me earlier. Congratulations and welcome back to AM.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sabra. It's a great honour.
4,000 students, how many of them will be actually able to study online?
So we have put in place over the last week 650 courses that will allow these students to keep in touch. That will cover a large fraction of the students. And then what I'm trying to do is to get our staff and our students to help the students who remain, because we have, you know, 650 combinations of degrees, and trying to make sure that we can, as I said, keep the people who are stuck in China in touch with happens over the semester, because we really don't know how things are going to play out.
The degree of difficulty in allowing that, given that the China's Great Wall when it comes to the internet is a bit of a challenge. Has that been challenging for you?
It is a challenge, and it is multifaceted in that there's just not one formula that works. So we have been working with a lot of our students who have a great deal of expertise, it turns out, in navigating the firewall. We have been working with Chinese officials themselves who have been cooperative, but it's a highly complex system, and so it needs to have multiple avenues of which we can get information in there to make sure it's reliable. And so we've been experimenting.
Have you got a lot of contingencies in place, I would imagine, or are you planning to put different contingencies in place, given that also some students might find it economically challenging given the fees they're having to pay.
Yeah, so what I'm trying to do is to make sure that our students stay in touch first, and we're going to worry about paying later. And so having a huge amount of flexibility so that the students get in, don't worry about the money, so they can opt out, or, you know, it's really in their control. But my focus is to make sure that they can do as much of their courses as they can while they're away. Then when they get here, we'll be able to speed them up, and we can speed them up faster the more they have done, and they're not going to pay until they actually get their courses done.
How tricky is it for you planning all of this? I mean, you might have students turn up in 8 days. You might not. Some might have to postpone.
So we're trying to be very flexible, and that's why this idea of not having cutoff dates, wanting to keep people in touch, making sure that we can handle if the students all arrive 8 days or if they arrive at the end of the semester. We have tried to build a system that can accommodate all of those options.
Economically, is it challenging for the ANU?
Yeah, it's not a lot of fun. It's a pretty big impact financially, but it is one that we have modeled in the past because we knew that some sort of economic shock like this could eventuate. So, you know, it is manageable, but it's not fun.
What about when the students are able to return? We're already hearing about fear of the virus is causing businesses to shut here because they're being shunned. How will you deal with that?
So that becomes a matter of communication. We have T-shirts that we have put out, which is viruses don't discriminate, and neither do we. And I want my staff and my students, who should be some of the most rational Australians, to actually be rational and to listen to the chief medical officer and realize that they have been very conservative and that people wandering around Australia are safe, no matter what they look like. People forget about proportionality. Every year, influenza is allowed to go through our community because it is decided to be a proportionate response to let that happen. Now, this is a different disease, and the chief medical officer and the health authorities are also trying to create a proportionate response, and I respect their views on this.
All right, just quickly, while you're talking about rational things, you're a Nobel Prize-winning scientist. The continued dismissal of climate change science?
That is becoming a little tiring, I will say. We need to keep on understanding it, but the reality is we need to act on it. And, you know, in the last couple of weeks, I've asked my Climate Change Institute, led by Mark Howden, to go through and figure out how we can go to sub-zero emissions as fast as possible. And I'm not talking 2050 here. I think we can probably do it here in the next year or two.
All right. Brian Schmidt, thank you very much for joining the program this morning.
My pleasure.
It's the Australian National University Vice Chancellor, Professor Brian Schmidt. One of the country's most prestigious Catholic boys' school is facing criticism over its handling of a grooming case involving one of its former coaches. There are now calls for the headmaster at St Kevin's College in Melbourne to resign after Four Corners discovered he gave a character reference for a now convicted child sex offender. Lauren Day reports that a warning, this story contains sexual references.
In the final term of 2019, a scandal erupted when footage of students singing an offensive chant on public transport went viral.
I wish that all the ladies! I wish that all the ladies!
St Kevin's College found itself at the centre of a PR nightmare, and radio talkback around the country was filled with fierce debate about private boys' school culture. Now, St Kevin's College is facing a far more serious crisis. In 2015, one of the school's former athletics coaches, Peter Keogh, was convicted of grooming a Year 9 student for sexual conduct. But because the victim was a child, the court was closed. Now, Four Corners can reveal that 59-year-old Keogh had sent inappropriate Facebook messages to the talented young runner, Paris Street, and took him to his home where he made sexual suggestions. Paris Street says he received no support from the school during the trial, and was devastated when he discovered that the current headmaster of St Kevin's College, Stephen Russell, wrote a character reference for the now convicted sex offender.
Just gutted. Yeah, gutted and just like flicked off. Like, this is how we think about you. We don't care.
Fellow student Ned O'Brien gave evidence at the trial. His mother Jo says she was appalled by Stephen Russell's decision.
That says it all. He should not be the headmaster. That's all. Honestly, that's just not on.
She says neither she nor her son heard anything from the St. Kevin's headmaster until the day her son had to appear in court. That morning, she says Stephen Russell wanted to know whether the boys would be wearing their school blazers.
I thought, wow, you really do want to cover this up. You really do want to keep this quiet.
Dean of Sport at St. Kevin's, Luke Travers, also appeared in court. He gave character evidence supporting Peter Keogh. When the prosecutor asked whether it was appropriate for a coach to text message a student saying, I love you, or kiss, 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 the dean replied, it depends on the context. Paris Street's lawyer is Judy Corton.
It is quite extraordinary that a headmaster and the Dean of Sport in particular will basically disregard the vulnerable student and support an offender. I mean, what planet are we on? And this is, you know, this is right at the hiatus of the Royal Commission.
Dr. Corton says the school's response had a profound impact on her client's mental health.
He ended up being hospitalised, needing psychiatric care. He was crushed by the institution. He was crushed.
The college provided a statement which said,
the actions of Peter Keogh were completely unacceptable and St. Kevin's College strongly condemns them. After his conviction, he was immediately banned from entering the school or having any contact with the college or its students.
St. Kevin's headmaster, Stephen Russell, declined to be interviewed.
Lauren Day reporting, and you can see the full Four Corners investigation on ABC TV tonight at 8:30 or on iView. Nearly half the applicants using a new federal government scheme to buy their first home are planning to live outside the major capitals on the East Coast. The program launched at the start of this year, and the government's trumpeting those figures as a win for its first home loan deposit scheme. Political reporter Alexandra Beach has more.
As this deposit scheme launched on New Year's Day, Sydney real estate agent Greg Anderson was hoping it would lead to a jump in first home buyers. So far, he says that hasn't happened.
To be honest with you, very little interest. I haven't heard much talk about it whatsoever.
This scheme allows first home buyers to purchase a property with a deposit of as little as 5%. Greg Anderson works in the Liverpool area in southwestern Sydney, where you can expect to pay $600,000 to $700,000 for a freestanding home. That's below the scheme's price cap for a Sydney property, but Mr. Anderson says for many it's still out of reach.
Houses are coming onto the market, selling very quickly with good growth in prices. Which is not real good news for the first-time buyers.
Figures released today show more than half the scheme's applicants are under 30, except in Sydney. The Housing Minister, Michael Sukkar, acknowledges that's a challenge.
I would absolutely recognise that there's no scheme, including this one, that is a silver bullet to the difficulties that particularly younger people face in our major capital cities where their jobs are.
But he says this scheme was partially designed to encourage people to look beyond the capitals.
I mean, one of the things that the Prime Minister and I wanted to do was make sure this didn't just become a Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane-centric scheme. And if we didn't pay such close attention to the way we designed it, it could have easily gone that way.
Just a month and a half into the program, around 6,500 loans are being processed. There are another 3,500 places left this financial year, with another 10,000 spots to become available from July. The average income for participants is around $67,000 for a single buyer or $110,000 for a couple. Most of the buyers have been single.
We've certainly put in place modest price caps around the country. And of course, if you're on a single income as a single, you're more likely to be someone who absolutely fits within those price caps.
Kristen Brookfield from the Housing Industry Association says it's encouraging to see so many buyers looking beyond the East Coast capitals.
Young people are wanting to get into the market. They're seeing the sense in getting to the market and they're going to those regional locations. They're getting houses which are more in the sort of $400,000 mark rather than that Sydney $700,000 mark.
But she's worried the price caps are still too restrictive to buy a new home in Darwin or Perth.
Alexandra Beach reporting. Prison officers in Victoria's youth justice system have called for danger money as assaults on staff in that state skyrocket. New data reveals the number of assaults on prison staff working in juvenile detention centres in Victoria has doubled in 2 years. A former guard has spoken to the ABC about his experience inside the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre near Bendigo. Beth Gibson reports.
Anthony Dunbar worked as a prison guard at the Malmesbury Centre for just 2.5 weeks last year.
We were basically having codes every single day. There was just assault after assault all the time.
During that time, he witnessed some traumatic events and was assaulted himself, hit in the head by an inmate wielding a TV remote control.
I got a fractured eye socket out of it. I still consider my assault very, very minimal compared to what others have. I mean, there's other guys that have actually had broken bones in their back. There's broken noses. There's been people that have been stabbed, everything.
New data from the Justice Department obtained by the ABC under the Freedom of Information Act shows that Anthony's experience is not an isolated one. The number of assaults on staff at Victoria's Malmesbury and Parkville Youth Justice Centres has more than doubled in 2 years. In the 2018-19 financial year, there were 130 assaults. That's the equivalent of almost one assault every 3 days. The Community and Public Sector Union is now calling for a 3.5% pay rise for juvenile justice staff.
They're one of the lowest paid occupations across all public service entities.
Branch Secretary Karen Batt says those workers deserve to be fairly compensated for the dangers they face on a daily basis.
We say given the complexity and the nature of their work, they certainly deserve a lift in pay.
The Department of Justice is already facing steep costs when it comes to medical insurance for its staff. Last financial year, it paid $4 million a month in WorkCover premiums, more than double the figure it was paying 2 years earlier. In a statement, Victoria's Youth Justice Minister Ben Carroll says violence against staff is unacceptable and the state government has introduced tougher penalties for offenders. He says it's also spent over $1 billion upgrading security and infrastructure and plans to build a new state-of-the-art facility 40 kilometres southwest of Melbourne. Union Secretary Karen Batt says that's not enough.
But we're 18 months away from that starting. What we do need is some capacity to relieve the pressure inside the two existing facilities as they stand now.
Anthony Dunbar says he'll never work at the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre again and was able to find work elsewhere.
I feel incredibly lucky that I had that in the background, and others just, they don't have that. They've got their families to support and everything, and they've got to go back in there day in, day out, and have to sort of, you know, watch over their shoulder, basically, to keep on watching, because there will be a next one and there'll be another one after that.
It's Anthony Dunbar, former guard at the Malmesbury Youth Justice Centre, ending Beth Gibson's report. The potential sale of A-League club Perth Glory to a London-based cryptocurrency group has taken sports commentators and sports fans by surprise. If the deal is approved, fans would be encouraged to invest in the club by purchasing cryptocurrency, an Australian and possibly world first. Bridget Fitzgerald prepared this report.
2019 was a hugely successful year for Perth Glory. The side took out the A-League Premiership, its first silverware in 15 years. But behind the scenes, things aren't so rosy. The club racked up losses of $2.9 million in the past year. Owner Tony Sage says he can't bear those losses alone, and he's spent the past 18 months looking for a partner.
You know, I can't compete as a sole owner with the Manchester Cities, which own Melbourne City, the Bakery Group, which owns in Brisbane, and Chinese now own two clubs in Australia.
Enter the London Football Exchange, or LFE.
The LFE is the world's first blockchain-based marketplace.
LFE's ambition is to own several soccer clubs with investment in cryptocurrency at the centre of the business model. Fans won't be forced to buy cryptocurrency, but investment is encouraged. If the sale goes through, Perth Glory would be the first in LFE's portfolio. And while nothing's been finalised, it's got football fans and analysts talking.
Absolutely fascinated.
Dr. Tom Heenan is a sports lecturer at Monash University.
This was a play to create a monopoly market within a stadium for Bitcoin, of which the new owner is obviously a prime investor of.
Whether this deal goes through or not, Dr. Heenan says it's clear that the era of sole club owners is over, and diversity is the key to keeping A-League clubs afloat.
I don't think A-League clubs can actually compete successfully in the Asian market against more cashed-up leagues. So to keep yourself competitive, I think you have to allow in foreign investment.
Jack Anderson, the Director of Sports Law Studies at the University of Melbourne, says the blockchain model could be worth considering.
Investment in football clubs around the world takes many, many forms and many structures. Supporters' trusts, we've even seen stock exchange launches and private equity. But this seems to be the first, if not a unique type of investment.
The sale is set to be confirmed this week.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. When Donald Trump makes his pitch to US voters for another 4 years running the country, it's likely to sound something like this.
I am thrilled to report to you tonight that our economy is the best it has ever been.
But how accurate is that?
Today, the truth about Donald Trump's economic record, the good and the bad, and how voters will judge that. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.